Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, Episode 40, and I'm your host, Nick Ortego. West Virginia teachers return to class after a nine-day strike. Could their progress have a domino effect in other states? And is a four-day school week the answer to low teacher pay? Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, we're chatting with Lynn Brunel, the author of Big Science for Little People, and she's going to give us a few tips about how you can make science fun for your students. Hello, everybody. Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Is your Alexa laughing at you? Do you have an Alexa?
No. Okay. Seriously, Nick, why do you think I would have
Russ
that?
Isn't here, so I have to ask
yeah,
you.
Yeah, of course, no, I don't.
Have you heard about this?
I mean, I know there's an Alexa.
Apparently.
One of my students ordered a Nerf gun without his parents knowing, and it delivered, and he was amazed it worked.
Listen to this. Can you hear this?
I don't get it.
That's an Alexa. Just like randomly giggling at people. And apparently...
Oh my gosh, that would freak me out.
Yeah, so apparently this is happening. Like people are just like doing random things in their home. They haven't said the word Alexa. And it's just... laughing,
yeah,
like this
no.
creepy laugh, mm-hmm. and this like happened in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Alexa's trying to fix the problem. They've acknowledged that it is a problem, and they're trying.
That is so scary.
Yeah, I have some in my house.
Wait, I thought you were going to say they just thought it was funny and they did this.
So no, it's freaking people out. But now I think people are realizing where it's coming from, because when the Alexa it lights up when it talks. But I mean, imagine being in the other room at 11 o'clock at night
and hearing a laugh.
Yeah, and hearing a laugh. Yeah. Like I would
Wait,
come around the corner with a baseball
happening?
Bat.
Why is it happening?
Amazon says we are aware and we are working to fix it. And then later on, Amazon said they plan to fix it by disabling the phrase Alexa laugh and changing the command to Alexa, can you laugh? The company says the latter phrase is less likely to have false positives. But if it's happening...
But if it's happening in the middle of the night, nobody's saying anything to Alexa.
I think they're still trying to figure out what's going on. And, you know...
We are aware of her maniacal laugh.
Right.
Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's...
Oh, man. I wish one day I would like to have an Alexa.
We'll just do that randomly throughout the rest of the show.
No.
Whenever you say something funny. Right. All right, so let's get into the teacher's lounge. What do you know?
Well, talking about West Virginia, you know, they did come through with a 5% teacher raise, ending...
5%? Like,
well, that
all that fighting and all they got... Like, what's the cost of living increase? 3%?
Slow down, lady. Whoa, 5% raise, but it's a 55-county strike. It lasted 9 days, and that is not their only topic. You know, somebody asked me about this the other day, and this is what I think about... the whole West Virginia and what's going to happen now? What will we see from this? I think of the painting, the woodblock print, the Great Wave.
Yeah, you're over my head.
You know the picture. It's the Japanese woodblock print, and it shows a large wave right in the middle.
I'm just going to say yes, so you keep
going. Oh my gosh, the Great Wave of Kanagawa. Okay, anyway, it's like really one of the most famous paintings, but they do a lot of spoofs on it or whatever, but in the middle of the picture you see the wave at the top at the crest, and you see the crest of the wave like fingers almost coming down, and I feel like that's where we are, you know, with the whole topic of teacher pay and this and that,
right.
And I think, you know, comes the tide, here it comes, because we've seen all this. If you've listened to this podcast, you have heard the build up, right?
Yeah.
And so here we are, and so in the woodblock print you see these fishermen down low, and they are, you know, they're about to get pummeled. So there are so many other states poised and ready to now, here it comes, to where it's going to be more with health benefits and job responsibilities.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a huge wave in my opinion, have changed.
Yeah, I think we'll see this continue to happen. And we should update the record because last week we basically were saying, oh, well, they're getting ready to go back to school and we thought there was a deal.
Right, and it didn't happen.
Apparently the Senate didn't live up to their end of the bargain, right, what was maybe said verbally.
And they extended it. Yep.
Right.
They're
so,
like, so
again,
sorry.
Kudos to the organization of these
and
teachers.
As we've said before, not every state allows strikes and things, you know, with teachers. And so I think we're going to see things in different forms, and you'll see things, you know, healthcare is a big one. I do think, you know, responsibility, testing, that those kind of things that are all part of, and of course we can't even ignore school shootings, you know, that part of the whole thing too. I think we're going to see a lot of change, and I think what has happened in West Virginia was huge. You know, what's their hashtag 55 strong, something like that. I think everybody's catching on and saying, you know, we're doing it. Oklahoma, Kentucky, these guys are ready.
Right.
And you're going to see something.
Well, apparently Oklahoma is planning some type of walkout in April, from what I understand. So they're next. And it really, Russ mentioned this last week, in Mississippi, they really don't have the ability to protest, to collectively protest.
Right.
And that's actually been stopped through law by the state, and that just really rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah, well, and you know, when you see a lot of issues with schools, either whether it's funding or even segregation or desegregation, a lot of judges, when it makes it to that level, they don't want to touch it. They don't want to touch it. And the reason why is because it's so different every state. It's so different. Mm-hmm. Everybody's allowed to kind of have their own. And so nobody wants that on their hands. So then it's like, I mean, I am a peaceful person. I'm a low profile person. So I can't see myself being a part of a large movement like that. But then on the other hand, I can see, well, gosh, you know, when you're people in law, you know, in government, they're not listening, they're not responding. Your judges don't really want to touch it. Then what do you do? And you know what? If you've got 55 counties that are saying, okay, we'll do it. I mean, there are strength in numbers, and I do think that that's going to happen elsewhere. And so, yeah, I mean, it's going to be different in every state. That's what I think.
Yeah. So to me, again, as I started to say at the top, 5%. I know that was their goal, and they got it, so I'm happy for them.
But there was more that they asked for, and they're not stopping.
Well, and I don't think 5% is enough, like, especially if you haven't gotten a raise in a while, because 2 years, cost of living, insurance, that was probably 6%, just naturally that you've had to absorb. So basically,
I don't agree that it is enough. It's not the ceiling, but it is a start.
It is.
And it was a start that they made happen.
Right.
Only them. I mean, every other outlet that they tried wasn't responding.
Right.
So that's why, I mean, like, whoa, now 5% is something that they made happen.
Yeah. I think we'll see a domino effect here for sure. And I think Oklahoma's probably next is what it sounds like, which really kind of transitions me into our next story, which is about a 4-day school week. Apparently, one Oklahoma school moved to the shortened schedule back in 2016 to cut costs. So they went to a 4-day week. Well, turns out they didn't really save a lot of money. But they did see more applicants of experienced teachers in that district. So my question to you is, well, it's really two questions. One, are the kids suffering with the 4-day school week, and parents, because they got to find something to do with their kids on Fridays or Mondays or whenever it is. And two, would you go work at a school, or would you be more likely to go work at a school district that only has 4-day school week?
Okay, so I don't think the children are suffering.
You think you can accomplish it in 4 days?
I do. I do think that any teacher would say that there is some dead time, you know, in the schedule. There is. Now, I mean, it would take away from things like that you maybe reserved for that fifth day that are kind of fun, exploratory. Mm-hmm. So that
library
would be
assistant, maybe.
No, I mean more like a makerspace, you know, time for things like that. So that, I would have to say, as a creative teacher, ooh, I wouldn't like that, you know. But I can see where they maybe would cut out a few you know, sometimes in a school week, children go to physical education twice, and they have recess. You know, some grades have recess twice. They have a morning recess and an afternoon 15-minute snack recess. And so some of those things might be cut a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that academically the children are going to suffer. I think that they may be, you know, a little more focused. even the teachers may be more focused. But as far as would it help with recruitment, if you're in an area that has a teacher shortage, yeah, I think if you switch to a four-day week, mm-hmm. I think that you would be more enticing, especially, you know, for experienced teachers, like you said, that, you know, they've been doing it so long at so little pay with so right. little respect and time. And so, yeah, that would probably be enticing to them. It'd be a reason for them to stay. For sure.
I think I would want to go work somewhere where, you know, yeah, four-day week, like sign me up.
Right.
And so I would even be probably willing to take slightly lower pay knowing I would only be working four-day weeks. But let's be honest, those days may be a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're jumping from, you know, 8 to 10 hours or whatever. But still, to have that extra day to take care of things, because like we've talked about on the show so many times, what teachers don't ever have time to do is go to the grocery store, go to the bank, make a doctor's appointment. Like, and if you had that extra day during regular business hours, that's huge, right?
It is, and it's so, so tough for a teacher because you want to take your children to the doctor and to the mm-hmm. orthodontist and, you know, and you can't because, you know, that is considered not okay for you to miss school to take your child to the doctor, but people miss your class all the time to go to the doctor or to, you know, whatever. So I do think that is nice to have a day built in that you can reserve, and it probably would cut down on teacher absences and student absences. You know, there's nothing worse than kids that knock off on Friday because they're running out of town for a longer weekend. Well, you know, you might would see a little less of that. So you probably would see more student attendance and teacher attendance. I can see where the district said that they didn't feel like they saved a lot of money, probably because their higher staff is still working 5 days.
Right.
And probably, you know, we say things like, oh, you know, the cost of heating and cooling a school and the lights and the gasoline for the buses and blah, blah, blah. That's one less day that all that's running. But probably when you really look at the large budget that these districts cover, mm-hmm. those utility kind of expenses probably are a drop in the bucket. Yeah. So I can see why they maybe didn't see a lot of change as far as the bottom line, but I bet it was a positive change for students and teachers. I
certainly think it's smart on districts, states, whatever, to consider the 4 day. If I'm taking you at your word that like you don't think that the teaching, the learning will suffer. If we could prove that the learning doesn't suffer when you go to this model, I would say, yeah, more states should hop on board with this, because you take someone like Oklahoma, who's, as we all know, right near Texas, and Texas pays better. And there's probably a lot of districts who you get that flight where the teacher just mm-hmm. goes over the border and makes a little extra money. Suddenly, now you're more competitive and you didn't have to spend the extra money because right. of that 4 day week.
And truthfully, that happens in every border state. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know people that go across state lines on either side of my state and they have a better opportunity. So it happens everywhere. We use Oklahoma a lot because they're in the hot spot right now with mm-hmm. their low pay and things and their teacher shortage, but it really happens everywhere.
On average, teachers in Texas make nearly $7,000 more than Oklahoma teachers. So how far would you be willing to drive for $7,000 more? An hour commute one direction, 30 minutes, 2 hours? What about you?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Especially an hour commute wouldn't bother a teacher because you are so...
That's a two-hour commute though, right? An hour one to...
Right, yeah. But at the end of your day, you are so overstimulated mm-hmm. that you would be fine with staring at a windshield just to have a little detox before you move into your evening responsibilities,
right.
you know?
Listen to a podcast, maybe?
Yes, that's right.
Right.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
I do know some teachers that part-time teach, but it's a full-time position. So, like, for example, art teachers or gifted teachers, library or media specialists, you know, they will teach half the year. That is something that districts are doing where they say, okay, well, this is a full-time position and nobody wants to do it full-time. So we're taking older teachers that still are willing and they'll work, one of them will work the fall semester and then you switch and have a new teacher for the spring semester.
Now, that's cool.
I don't know that works, you know, when you're like self-contained second grade class.
Right.
They don't need, oh, whoa, fruit basket turnover with a new teacher. But with some of these, you know, some of these school districts are getting a little more creative in other areas to be able to, you know, keep teachers employed, but also give them, you know, kind of the break and fill positions. So there's creative ways to fix your teacher shortage if you piece it together, or like you said, consider a four-day week and see what happens.
Right. That's true. And you can certainly do it as a pilot program, I think, in a lot of states, to where you go, well, let's try it in this district that's near the border and see if that doesn't help with recruitment. So, you know, if I was a state superintendent of education, it's something I would certainly create a committee on or something just to look at, you know?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of states do a half day now on Wednesdays where the students get out at noon. And
is it like PD the second half of the day for the teachers, or are they done?
It is one half day a month.
Yeah.
It's professional development. And I think another half day a month is for conferences. And then the other two half days, the teachers are released.
That's cool.
So that allows them time to, you know, now you hope your kid gets sick on, you know, that Wednesday that is a release day.
And just for everyone's FYI, the apparently Oklahoma's targeting a $10,000 pay raise over a 3-year period. So we'll see how that goes. That may be a topic of discussion in about 4 weeks or so. And one of the dates they're looking at is a possible walkout on April the 2nd. So right around the corner. Are you ready for the bright idea?
Yeah.
We actually have a really creative author when it comes to science and doing projects and stuff. And she used to write for Bill Nye, the Science Guy.
Oh.
Yeah. And she's got a few books out. And this is just a great interview about like ways you can get kids interested in all sorts of science. And she has a new book coming out. So stay tuned. Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment is a 4-time Emmy Award-winning writer for the Bill Nye the Science Guy. Lynn Brunell is also the author of Big Science for Little People, 52 Activities to Help You and Your Child Discover Wonders of Science. And Lynn has a brand new book coming out in less than a month on April 3rd. She will release Turn This Book Into a Beehive. Lynn Brunell, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
First up, I got to ask, because it's piqued my interest, what's it like writing for Bill Nye the Science Guy?
It was the best job. It was so much fun. It was kind of like a combination of Mr. Wizard meets Saturday Night Live. So it was it tapped into my love for writing funny things, but also making kind of difficult concepts that some people are intimidated by, making them accessible and fun. Because in my experience, if it's funny, if you laugh, you remember it.
And I'm guessing that's kind of how you were like, I've got to turn all this into a book, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, one of the books that I'd written was a book called Pop Bottle Science, and that happened as a result of when I was at the Nye Show, I always had a bottle of water on my desk, and people would come in and say, well, I'm not really sure I understand this concept, and I would grab the pop bottle more often than not to do a little demonstration to show what I was talking about. And I thought, oh my gosh, there's a book here. I've been doing this. And these plastic pop bottles are like little mini science laboratories. And so I wrote a book called Pop Bottle Science, and the book comes inside the bottle.
And that's really cool. And we're going to talk more about some of these creative things you have, because I know, just kind of looking at your last book, The Big Science for Little People, don't you have something in there where you use a bottle to make like a lava lamp or something?
Oh my gosh, I use bottles all the time because, you know, they really are perfect little mini science labs. They're waterproof, they're airproof, they're see-through, they're portable. So they're a terrific thing for kids, and they're also, you know, accessible. They're a great thing for kids to play with. But yeah, if you put water and like vegetable oil and food coloring and an Alka-Seltzer in a plastic pop bottle, you can make an awesome lava lamp.
That's really cool. Your new book, again, is titled Turn This Book Into a Beehive. And
yes,
the title alone, that's interesting. Turn this book, like you literally turn the book into a beehive?
You actually do turn it into a beehive. So, you know, as a science writer, I've got a lot of people always coming up to me and saying, you know, how about this? And can you explain this? And then you hear about all these problems. And one of the problems that I'd read about was the beehive dilemma, the honeybee hive collapse disorder, which is happening. And it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And there are all sorts of theories about why it's happening. You know, is it global warming? Is it pesticides? Are these mites? You know, it's like, it's a combination of everything. But like, when you write for kids, you don't want to say, hey, kids, this is a really bad thing, the end. You want to be able to empower them and say, you know, is there something that you can do? So that's where this book came from. It turns out that mason bees, which are wild bees, which represent like 98% of the bees on the planet. Honeybees, the social bees, are 2% of the bees that are living on the planet. But wild bees, if you make them a home, they will actually come. And they're amazing pollinators. They pollinate, one mason bee can pollinate as many as 100 honeybees. And so that's what you do. You actually take the outside cover of this book and you turn it inside out. And then the last signature of pages, you roll into tubes, which sort of mimic, hollow grasses or reeds. So yeah, no matter where you are in the country, different species of wild bees will come and nest there. And if you've got them nesting in your garden or your yard or your fire escape or your pea patch or your park, they're going to be pollinating the flowers that are nearby and really alleviating the pressure that's on the honeybee. So it's pretty amazing that, you know, what I wanted to do is come up with a way to, an optimistic way for kids to actually feel empowered. So it's kind of, the book itself is a kind of a environmental power tool that any kid can make and use and make a difference.
And as you probably know, all around the country, teachers, there's a lot of focus on STEM education. And where does this really fit in there? This is more environmental sciences, this new book?
Well, it is. Yeah, it's environmental science, but it's also, you know, biological sciences, because it explains everything about bees, social and solitary. So it's got all that stuff going for it, too. And then you've got a little engineering component because you're making this house. So it's kind of, you know, it definitely falls within STEM. Definitely.
Good, good. So why is it so important to really capture kids? I guess, what age group do you target with this book? And then why is it important to kind of get them at a younger age?
Well, my philosophy is that, you know, you got to, especially with girls, we got a little bit of a leaky pipeline. The kids, when they're younger, that's when they start to decide whether or not they like science or math or technology, you know, and they decide pretty early. Around 11, they've done these studies that show that around 11, that's when they decide, am I a science person or am I not a science person? And my philosophy is, yes, everybody's a science person or a STEM person, because it's all based on wondering how the world works. And so I think we have to kind of, for me, I'm thinking we've got to rebrand this and show how cool it is, because we spend a lot of time in our culture showing that being smart kind of isn't cool. I mean, look at where it's always the, you know, the smart kid is always the sort of geeky butt of the joke on sitcoms, or, you know, you can actually dress up as a nerd for Halloween. So what are we saying to these kids, right? So what I want to do is make it early on and show how amazing this world is, and how if you ask questions and you do a little experiment and you do some observations, that you can learn these amazing things. And once you've got these skills, you can change the world.
I feel like the discussion about girls, women in science has been going on probably for about 5 to 10 years. Have you really seen a difference now that it's kind of on the radar?
Well, you know, I am brought into it right now. Last year, I was invited to go and speak at the UN about girls in STEM, and it was girls in STEM in the space sector. And it was a fascinating experience, because we had people in all sorts of aspects of it. A lot of people, you know, they were astrophysicists, there were astronauts, there were people at the high end of government jobs. And then, you know, all trying to solve this problem, like, why do we not have more diversity at the top in these jobs? And a lot of the conversation was around, you know, well, we have to focus on hiring women at these levels. But honestly, I think it's like way back to preschool. I think it's like, you got to get down into making it cool, making it accessible, making it fun. I mean, if you think about it, if girls are deciding at age 11 whether or not it's cool or not to do science or technology or engineering, make it cool. You know, I don't think video games are starting to change, but for the most part, they're aimed at boys, and boys have a lot of characters that they can choose from. Girls, you know, the characters that they traditionally have had to choose from have been either just silly or hypersexualized. So it kind of really indicates that's not a world for them. Right. So I think we have to make it welcoming and open early on, and then, you know, start growing a seed.
If you're a teacher, how do you win over the kids who think science isn't their thing?
Well, that's my whole soapbox, is that it's all about looking, wondering, and asking why, and then sort of seeing if. I mean, so it's not as intimidating. I have a lot of parents that come up to me and say, oh, I'm not a science person, but I know it's important for my kids. And I'm like, oh, so the first thing you need to know is that you are a science person. If you've ever wondered anything, like why is the sky blue, or, you know, how does it rain, or why does a basketball fall to the ground? You know, those are all science questions. We start off as scientists. I mean, kids are natural born scientists. They're always asking why. I mean, even before two, even pre-verbal, you got kids dropping off peas off of high chairs. And that's, it's an experiment. What happens if I do this? It's what science is. You do it and you observe it. And then maybe you change it a little bit. And so everybody's got that in them. And it's fun. I think what kills kids' interest is when it's not presented in a fun way. And oh my gosh, science is nothing but fun.
You have a story where you maybe had a parent or a teacher or a child kind of give you some feedback that made you realize that this is worth doing.
Early on, my first teaching experience was way back in the day when they would take behavior problem children and put them into a classroom. So anybody that was causing a trouble in a traditional classroom would be stuck in another classroom. And that was my classroom. Mm-hmm. And it was grades 4 through 8. I had 25 quote unquote problem kids. And, a couple of them were, scary. And I was young. But I loved this classroom because most of these kids were only quote unquote problems because they weren't learning in the same way that the other kids were easily learning. So it became very apparent to me that these kids could do stuff. They just needed a different approach. One kid was told to me he couldn't do sequencing. They said, he couldn't read a story and tell you what was the beginning, the middle, and the end, which is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And so, but I noticed that this kid was drawing all the time, and he was really sophisticated drawings. And so this is also dates how long ago this was. It was back in the day of film strips. I made a film strip of a Japanese myth that we were reading, and I drew the pictures and I showed this boy the film strip. And then I said, draw a picture of the beginning. And it was a story about a turtle, and then draw a picture of the, what happens in the middle, and then draw a picture of what happens at the end. And he totally drew these amazing pictures. And then it was like, okay, write a sentence about what's going on in your picture. This kid could sequence, but he came through it from a visual point of view. Mm-hmm. And there was a girl in the class who she couldn't do. She was in eighth grade, and she had, they were studying the excretory system, and she couldn't get her urethra from her ureters straight and all this stuff. And she just hated it. Right. And so I turned it into a song, and it was, there's only one Aretha Franklin, so there's only one urethra. And so we made it, and we made a little song about it, and she remembered it. She was a musical kid. And so, she got an A in the test, except for she called it, she labeled the ureters, and then she labeled the urethra Franklin. Which I thought was funny. But it was great because it showed me that, there's different approaches. If you make something fun and accessible and accessible in the way that a kid can reach it, then you're gonna hit the fascination button. And that's the thing. The fascination button's there. It's how you get to it.
Have you ever really thought of, like, where do you get these ideas? Like, you read all these experiments and you just came up with that quick device to learn science. Like, where does it come from for you?
I wish I knew. It's that wonderful thing about when when you're being a writer and it kind of comes through you. I think it's just about listening and staying open, because sometimes you'll hear something in a conversation or something dawns on you and you're like, hey. And that's how the Beehive book came about. I have a garden, and I was thinking, I've heard about bees. I'm a little intimidated by bees and blah, blah, blah. And then, I saw this mason beehive, and I thought, oh, I wonder if you can make that. And this would be cool for kids. So I think it's just a matter of being open, and I don't know where they come from, but they come through you.
The book is, again, Turn This Book Into a Beehive. It's going to be available April 3rd. I think you can already pre-order it on Amazon. It looks like it's going to be at Barnes & Noble's, Books A Million, IndieBound, Workman's website at workman.com. Anywhere else, just about anywhere you can find it, right?
I hope it's everywhere you can find good books.
Good stuff. Well, again, Lynn Brunell, we appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
I'm ready.
All right. First question. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
And I can't say STEAM, can I? Because that's more than one subject.
Yeah, that would be like...
See, now I'm a multitasker, right? If I say science, I also mean that I'm going to approach it from a language point of view and an art point of view and all that stuff. So I'll say science.
Okay, fair enough. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
That learning is more fun than we think it is. That that approaching how to learn should be more engaging, I think. You know, I think we get stuck a lot in the, I'm going to tell you the information, and then I'm going to test you on the information. Okay, I'm going to tell you the information, and then I'm going to test you on the information, as opposed to an experiential kind of like, hey, let's, you know, let's see what happens when you do this, and you figure it out. You know, just, I think that's what we're not teaching. We're not teaching the fun of teaching.
Right. What does every child deserve?
Oh, every child deserves to have exposure to wonder.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
Cultivating that wonder and cultivating that joy of learning.
What do you think the best gift to give an educator is?
Get them excited. I think, teaching, you know, most educators that I know have that joy, but like if that was something you could package and give them, like, you know, that passion and that excitement, that's what, it, you know, it lights kids on fire.
Which teacher changed your life?
I had a couple. I had Mr. Thibault, my high school biology teacher. He was this little Frenchman, and he would defy us. he taught biology, and he would defy us to, I defy you to get, you know, 10 questions right about plant stomata, you know, and of course you take that challenge, but he was fun. He would do things like he wouldn't just tell us about diffusion. He would put peppermint oil in the sink and then ask us to raise our hand if we started to smell anything, you know? And so he would show us these things. And he really did bring that sort of magical wonder to things, and which was nice at a high school level, you know?
Last question, pen or pencil?
Pencil.
Why's that?
Totally pencil. Because I like to erase.
Lynn, we appreciate you taking the time to chat with us, and hopefully everyone will run out and grab the book when it's released in April.
I hope so, and thank you so much for having me on the show.
That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or a comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and hit that subscribe button, and we'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortigo, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed!